You've seen the ads. You've watched the commercials. The Marines are looking for a few good men. The tough, the proud, the few, the Marines. The Marines are tough, there's no question about that. My older brother Dave served in the Marine Corps and was involved in the most intense fighting in Vietnam up in the DMZ back in the Khe San and Con Tien and all of the various battles that were raging in those turbulent times. And Dave is one who is loyal to the Marine Corps and would say, yes, the Marines are tough. In fact, when Dave was being trained at Camp Pendleton after having gone through boot camp in San Diego, transferred to Pendleton, he continued on his training there when he was given a few hours to go off base, a time of resting and relaxing. So he put his Marine Corps uniform on and went walking down the streets of a town when he saw a red convertible driving by. An older gentleman was driving the convertible, and there in the car with that older gentleman were three attractive blonde young ladies. Well, Dave, having been in the Marine Corps for several months and not having all that much freedom, found himself impulsively waving to those gals as they drove by. Hey! And he was in his uniform waving to the gals, knowing the Marines are the tough and the proud and the few. And the car came to a screeching halt. And the older gentleman opened the door and stood up. Dave, much to his shock and chagrin, realized it was the commanding officer of the base. And the commanding officer walked over to where Dave at this time was just sort of frozen at attention. Private, do you always wave to the officer's daughters when they drive by? And Dave said, no, sir. You don't? Well, what were you doing? I was waving, sir. Well, you said you don't wave to the commander's daughters. I don't, sir. I do, sir. I don't know, sir. And the commander looked at my brother Dave and said, well, so that you'll stop and think about who you wave at, I'm going to have you stand right here, face that stop sign right there on the road, and stand saluting that stop sign until I get back. And so Dave stood there, yes, sir, and snapped to, and saluted that stop sign for the next, hour and a half, until the commander came back and dismissed him. They're tough, no doubt. I had an uncle that was an incredible man. Chip, maybe you knew him, I don't know. But this guy was a wonderful athlete and the world champion karate expert of his time about 15 years ago. He was the champion karate guy. No one could stop him. No one could even compete with him. He was awesome, breaking boards, breaking walls with his bare hand. And he was enlisting in the Marine Corps. He only lasted one day. The first day, he killed himself saluting. Do you know him, Chip? Yeah, no. No, that wasn't true. Now, Dave's situation was that I didn't really have an uncle. But I do have a brother, Dave, who is in the Marines or was in the Marines. And indeed, the Marines are tough. But yet, in my reading this week, I am convinced that the Marines are wimps in comparison to the armies of Assyria. Now, catch this. I've told you previously of the cruelty and brutality of the Assyrian armies, how they would take their captives and put hooks in their nose and lead them through the nose back to the place of captivity. how they would put hooks in the jaws of people. I came across some more reading this week that described that when a man disobeyed an order to the slightest degree in the Assyrian army, his commanders would not have him simply standing saluting a stop sign, but they would come and skin that individual alive. If you disobeyed your commander, even to the slightest, you were skinned alive. Then they would take the skin of that soldier and make a banner out of that skin that would be carried by that particular unit, reminding that unit, as this skin flapped in the wind, the price of disobedience. They were a cruel, brutal army. They were a very tough group of soldiers. In fact, the Assyrian army was the ones that invented, if you would, the siege strategy. When they would war against a city, the Assyrians would surround that city with tens of thousands of soldiers, and even though they could easily invade the city, they wouldn't. They would just surround it for days, weeks, months, even years upon occasion. And they would wait until the people inside of the city would slowly starve to death for lack of food or die of thirst for lack of water. Then they would go into that city and take the bodies of the people that died in the siege, chop off their heads, and place their heads on poles all around the outside of the city so that other people passing by the city might realize that they better snap to and better give in when the Assyrians came their way. They were the ones that invented the battering ram. They were the ones that developed ramps that would be built into a city if they chose to attack before the city had died out internally. Now, this is the situation in chapter 23, or 22, pardon me. The Assyrians, this brutal, awesome army, this murderous machine of war, was moving towards Jerusalem. The burden of the Valley of Vision. The Valley of Vision is a reference to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was built, of course, on a couple of hills, but surrounded by dominating mountains. So in a sense, although being built on hills, Mount Zion being the primary one, you could still look down from the surrounding dominating mountains, and thus it is called the Valley of Vision. What aileth thee now that thou art wholly gone up to the housetops? When the people knew that an attack was coming, or that trouble was heading in their direction, they would go up to the top of their houses being flat, and would stand at the top and look out over the city walls to see what was coming down, what was going on. And here are the people, standing on top of their houses to see what's coming. Verse 2, thou that art full of stirs, a tumultuous city, a joyous city, thy men are not slain with the sword, nor dead in battle. All thy rulers are fled together, they are bound by the archers. All that are found in thee are bound together, which have fled from far. Verse 4, therefore said I, look away from me, I will weep bitterly. Labor not to comfort me because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. It is a day of trouble, a day of treading down and perplexity by the Lord God of hosts in the Valley of Vision, breaking down the walls and of crying to the mountains. And Elam bare the quiver with chariots of men and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. And it shall come to pass that thy choicest valleys, they shall be full of chariots. And the horsemen shall set themselves array at the gate. Verse 8, and he discovered the covering of Judah. And thou didst look in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. You have seen also the breaches of the city of David that are many, and you gathered together the waters of the lower pool, and you numbered the houses of Jerusalem. and the houses have you broken down to fortify the wall. You made also a ditch between the two walls for the water of the old pool. But you have not looked unto the maker thereof, neither had respect unto him that fashioned it long ago. Verse 12. And in that day did the Lord God of hosts call to weeping and to mourning and to baldness and to girding with sackcloth. And behold, joy and gladness, slaying oxen, killing sheep, eating flesh, drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. And it was revealed in mine ears by the Lord of hosts, saying, surely this iniquity shall not be purged from you until you die, saith the Lord of hosts. At the time when the Assyrians were moving in, at the time when the people were climbing up to the tops of their house and looking out, seeing the imminent invasion, knowing that the day would be coming when they would be surrounded by the army of Assyria, the people, we are told, rolled up their sleeves and went to work. They built up their armies. They fortified the city of Jerusalem by tearing down the houses inside of the city walls and using that material to strengthen the wall itself. Where there was breaches, they filled in the gaps. And they dug a pool. They dug a way where water could flow from the outside of the city gates into the city, that they might be supplied with water during the siege they knew was coming. Now, when did this take place? This took place, as we shall see, in the days of King Hezekiah. And Hezekiah saw the threat that was coming down. And Hezekiah called the people to be prepared for the day of trouble. They built up their armies. They mobilized their horses and chariots. They fortified the wall. Hezekiah ordered a digging from the spring of Gihon outside of the city of Jerusalem all the way to the pool of Siloam inside the city walls, 1,777 feet. He had them dig underneath the ground through solid rock, that the water might flow from the spring outside, which they then covered up and hid into the city itself, that they might be supplied with water in the day of siege. If you go to Jerusalem with us in May, we will be walking through this 1,777-foot tunnel called Hezekiah's Tunnel. It's an amazing place to walk through. It winds and curves like a snake, and yet what happened was, in a miraculous feat of engineering, two teams, one starting at the Pool of Siloam inside the city, the other starting at the Spring of Gihon outside the city, dug through the various hardnesses of the rocks and actually met together in the middle, joining the tunnel together in a remarkable feat of engineering. The water could then flow freely into the city. And the Assyrians, the theory was, would not know where the water was coming from, and they could hold off the siege a little bit longer. Now here, Isaiah says, I wept bitterly when I realized what was happening. For in this day of adversity, in this day of trouble and testing, the people went ahead and built up their armies and built up their walls and made preparations in digging the tunnel of the spring of Gihon. But then they also went about partying, eating, feasting, and drinking. Tomorrow we'll probably die, they said. What matters it? We'll just go ahead and party. We've strengthened our city to the best of our ability, and now we might as well just kick back and see what happens. And the Lord rebukes the people through Isaiah, because verse 11 tells us, you have not looked to the maker thereof. Oh, you've engineered your water supply, he says, but you have not looked to the maker of that spring, the supplier of the waters. You've worked hard, but you haven't sought me. You've used your creativity. You've used your abilities. You've expanded your energy. You've done a lot, but you haven't looked to me. Therefore, he says, death is imminent. Your plans won't work. Your preparations are for naught. Now, keeping a finger here, I'm going to ask you to turn to a second passage that really amplifies this story for us. Turn to 2 Chronicles 32. And this is the story of that event that Isaiah was prophesying about. The time when Sennacherib and his boys would be moving into Judah to besiege Jerusalem. Sennacherib was the king of Assyria. And in verse 1 of chapter 32, 2 Chronicles, after these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities and thought to win them for himself. And when Hezekiah, who was a godly king, a friend of Isaiah, when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city, and they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, "Why should the king of Assyria come and find much water?" They stopped up all other sources of water, except for the spring of Gihon, which, as I spoke earlier, they covered and had secretly flowing into the city. Verse 5, also he strengthened himself. He built up all the wall that was broken down and raised it up to the towers. And he made darts and shields in abundance. Verse 6, and he set captains of war over the people, and gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city. And he spake comfortably to them. Be strong, he said, and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. For there be more with us than with him. With him is the arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. Here Hezekiah, seeing the invasion coming, made these preparations that we spoke of previously. And then he called his people together and said, "Don't freak out. More is with us than is with them." Oh, numerically, that was not necessarily true if you were talking about people. But Hezekiah was tapping into something which Elisha the prophet had said earlier. You recall when Elisha was in Dothan in 2 Kings chapter 6? The king of Syria, not Assyria, but Syria, was out to get him. Because wherever the king of Syria went, whatever ambushes he set up, whatever strategy he plotted out, it was always revealed to the people of Israel before he could do it. And he called his boys together and said, "Hey, there's a spy in our midst. Somebody is telling the Jews every time I make a plan what I'm going to do. And they adjust their plans and I can't accomplish my plans and dispositions. Who's the spy?" He felt he had a spy scandal on his hands. When one of the wise men came and said, "King, there's no spy here. But there's a prophet in Israel, Elisha. And he knows every step you take, every move you make, every breath you take. Someone's watching you. And the Lord is telling Elisha the prophet everything you're thinking, and he's telling the people of Israel. And the king said, if that be so, we will destroy this man. Where is he? In the city of Dothan. Surround the city, the king of Syria said. So they went and surrounded the city and were going to crush that little town and take that prophet and do him in. The morning when they came, Elisha's servant Gehazi came and said, Master, we're surrounded by the enemy. And he started to freak out. And Elisha tranquilly and with serenity looked at Gehazi, his servant, and lifted his head towards heaven and said, Lord, open his eyes. And suddenly, Gehazi's eyes were opened. And he saw that surrounding all of the Syrians were innumerable numbers of angels. And the angels had those Syrian soldiers covered. And Gehazi was at peace. And of course, Elisha was protected. Years later, Hezekiah picks up on that story. And Hezekiah says, Lord, we know that you are with us. People, don't freak out. Don't panic. Understand this, people. Know this, that the Lord is with you, and that's more impressive and important than the Assyrians which are surrounding you. Now hang with me here. This is where it gets very confusing. As I studied this, I was perplexed by this greatly. Lord, I don't understand. Here is Hezekiah, a godly king. One of the great kings in the history of Judah. Fortifying the city, doing what he can, preparing the army, which was a logical thing to do, and then encouraging his people, saying, trust in the Lord, he's with us. Don't freak out, don't give up. And yet the prophet Isaiah comes on the scene at this time and says, you're missing the mark. You've made these preparations, but you're still eating and drinking and going about your business in a way that is displeasing to Jehovah, to the Lord. And you're going to get crushed. And I thought, Lord, what is the deal? This does not seem to coordinate. But if you look carefully, and we're almost done here, but it's important that you see this very, I think, extremely significant point. Although all the plans were made and the word was shared and encouragement was given, the turning point did not come until, as the intimidation continued in verses 9 through 19, you can read it at your leisure, when Sennacherib and Rabshakeh and the boys began to tease and mock and hassle and harangue against the people of God and send letters threatening them and words intimidating them. It was then that Hezekiah, verse 20, Hezekiah the king got the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amos, and they prayed and they cried to heaven. 1 Kings 19:35 tells us specifically they took all of these letters that were written threatening them and went into the temple, Isaiah the prophet, Hezekiah the king, and bowed down and spread them out and said, Lord, help us. It was then that the battle was won. The tide was turned. The Lord, who had previously said destruction and judgment is coming down, saw and heard the prayers of Hezekiah and Isaiah, their sincerity, their integrity, their humility in bowing before him, that the Lord did a miracle. What happened? As 185 Assyrians surrounded the city waiting for them to starve to death. After Isaiah and Hezekiah prayed, That evening, the Lord sent one single angel to go through that camp. And the next morning, 185,000 Assyrians woke up dead. You think you had a tough night. They were killed. One single angel destroyed the entire besieging army. Oh, the power of the Lord. Dispatching just a single angel. Angels are promised to you. They're ministering spirits assigned to you, traveling with you. The power of the Lord. Now, here's what really impresses me. We come to church like this. And we hear encouraging words from the scriptures. Perhaps a brother will share with you a word, hey, trust in God. Believe in the Lord. He's promised never to leave you or forsake you. He's promised to provide all of your needs according to His riches. By His stripes you're healed. Delight yourself in the Lord and He'll give you the desires of your heart. All kinds of precious and potent promises are given to us. But what do? We receive those words and say, yeah, far out. All right. Good. Neat. Great. And then we go back home and say, now, how can I build my city walls? How can I make this happen? Who can I call? What can I do? I've got to make it happen. And we build our city walls and we get our chariot wheels going and we polish up our shields and we dig our tunnels and we do everything. There's nothing wrong, folks, with doing. It's important that we do. And yet, we hear the scriptures, we hear the truths, we hear the principles, and because we have heard, we think that we're doing in seeking God. Folks, listen, every ear tuned in, that is not necessarily so. You can be an expert in the scriptures. You can be so receptive of truth and retaining all kinds of understanding. But if it does not translate to doing what Hezekiah finally did with Isaiah the prophet, on his knees before the Lord in humility, in desperation, in sincerity, in brokenness, all of the promises and encouragements will profit you nothing. Hear the word of the Lord today. It is not enough just to hear and to think because I'm hearing, I must be seeking the Lord. Because I understand the principle, I must be acting out that principle. Many of you have decisions to make concerning careers, concerning relationships, concerning ministries. Many of you are going through all kinds of trials, perhaps with finances, perhaps with people that you work with, perhaps with kids that are not turning out the way that you hoped they would. And you come to a place like this and you hear the word of the Lord as the scriptures being opened. But the Lord will say to you and to me that hearing is not necessarily doing. You can know all the promises and be in all the right Bible studies. But until, like Hezekiah, you fall on your face in brokenness before the Lord and say, I need you, Lord. Not, how can I quickly leave the amphitheater and make some more phone calls and figure out some more programs? Lord, I must seek you if I have to stay all day. I must seek you. I need you, Lord. I need you, Lord. It's the Lord that we need. And that's why we gather in a place like this. To quit building the walls and digging the tunnels and say, Lord, ultimately, I need a miracle, an angel to be dispatched and come and do work that's beyond my comprehension, understandings, or abilities. I need you. In closing, I know this word does not apply to everyone, but I know it applies to bunches, to many. Many have fallen into the subtle error, it's a subtle one, of thinking that because you come and hear about prayer, that you're praying. Because you hear about seeking God, that you must be seeking God. But you're not. Not like Isaiah and Hezekiah finally did, on their face, in the temple of the Lord, with their problems spread out, saying, Lord, help. I want to encourage you this morning, now, as we close and sing, five or six songs of worship together. I want to encourage you to apply this understanding today. Questions, struggles, needs. Will you do what Isaiah and Hezekiah did? And come and bow down before the Lord and spend time here until the service ends, or even beyond that if you wish. And say, Lord, it's time that I really talk to you. I'm in your house with your people. And I need to talk to you about this trouble, this trial, this lack of direction, this need, this tension I have. I need you, Lord. You see, if I just dismissed this service and you went your way and got home and turned on the Giants-Braves game or went out and mowed your lawn or made your phone calls for whatever problems are troubling you or whatever it might be, that would be a terrible injustice to you. We need to seek the Lord today. Bunches of us do. So as we stand, I'm going to ask you, as you feel led, to come and pray. And perhaps this whole place will fill up and the aisleways will fill up. That would be wonderful. Perhaps you might just kneel where you're at right there. And if you say, man, I don't feel attacked today. I just feel like I'm on victory. I'm moving in the power and flow of God. Things are going great. Then you just stay there and worship. And thank the Lord that you're in that place. And realize that next time the siege of Assyrians come, that you need to be in this place on your knees. The place of submission, brokenness, encountering the Lord. I think we have enough churches and enough meetings where we talk about seeking God and too little where God is actually sought. May we as a people today seek the Lord. Whatever battle might be raging around you or within you, seek the Lord. I'm going to ask the elders and deacons if you would be sensitive just to kind of flow throughout the congregation of folks that are coming and perhaps lay hands on and pray with those that are right now seeking Him. Shall we stand together? And Lord, I pray, as we stand before You, as we worship You, Lord, that we might be thankful for the victory which we have in Christ Jesus. And Lord, many of us today have come into this service feeling tensions and struggles. And You've provided this sanctuary, Lord, that we might seek You. Lord, may that be true.